Real stories, real change, rooted in the power of nature. You're listening to Unearthing Optimism from the Arbor Day Foundation. Hi, I'm Dan Lamb. Today we're joined by someone whose work has shaped the way millions of people think about science, storytelling, and the world we share, Hank Green. As an entrepreneur, science communicator, and co-founder of the educational video company Complexly, Hank has spent his career making complicated ideas accessible and building communities around curiosity, empathy, and action. For our conversation, we'll explore the internet's role in shaping environmental conversations and choosing hope in the face of negativity. Welcome to Unearthing Optimism. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, we've got a lot of things to get through, but before we get into some of the work you're doing today, I wanted to go back to maybe early Hank Green and reflect on maybe even some of your childhood memories around nature that still stick with you. And I know for me as a child, one of my first wow moments in nature was when our family went off to the Rocky Mountains of Colorado as a little kid to see, coming from Nebraska, to see like these mountains and waterfalls and forests. It was just all breathtaking for me. I remember that as a kid. And I'm just wondering if you remember any of your first wow moments in nature as a child.
I do. I mean, I remember, like, there's a certain amount of just, of, like, human in nature that isn't, like, really wow. I remember being a kid and just, like, running around in the forest, like, racing my brother. There was this tree that had fallen in the woods, and we would race along the trunk to try and, like, you couldn't let your feet touch the ground, and you had to race along the trunk, and it had all these branches that were sticking up all over the place. And of course, he always beat me. And if he didn't, he changed the rules so that he did anyway. But it was exactly the kind of thing where, like, it felt so dangerous, but there was always something to grab onto if you were going to fall. And it made me feel very, like, capable. And also, I don't know, just like running around like a kid in the forest. Very good feelings, getting ticks.
Wish we had more and more of that. But thanks for sharing that,
yeah,
Hank.
I wish less ticks. I do remember being, like, really smacked in the face as a, like, probably a 13 or 12 year old by the sky. Just nighttime, outside, alone, cold breeze, look up and you're like, oh no. this is so much bigger than me. What is this even? And just, like, really feeling both the, like, weight and the lift of that at the same time.
So I know you grew up with a father who worked at the Nature Conservancy. And at the Arbor Day Foundation, we know the Nature Conservancy very well. For decades, we've planted trees with the Nature Conservancy all around the world. They're an amazing organization. And I'm sure that had to have had an impact on you. When you were at home with your parents and you talked about environmental issues growing up, was it scientific? Was it practical? Was it emotional? How did your parents and your dad talk to you about nature?
I think there was a good mix, honestly. So my mom also worked for a sustainability organization when I was in high school and for the Science Center for a while when I was a kid. And so I got all kinds of, I got so, so lucky. But the conversations were often, I think, just the way that most families have them. There's sort of a morality to, you know, we don't want to like pre-producing all of this trash. We don't want to be wasting this water. We don't want to be wasting this electricity. All of this stuff comes from somewhere, and it all has an impact. And so, like, yeah, just sort of that feeling. And I could see it in my son now, who's 9. And you know, Montana is a strange place to be growing up because there's a lot of wood, but there's also a lot of wood industry. And so his class, we have to have the conversation of, like, you know, it's bad to cut down trees, but also it can be, there is a right way to cut down trees because we do need to build homes and we need, like, these things are part of the world. And so it isn't just like tree cut bad. It's like there are, like, sustainable ways to harvest timber. And that's a very sort of a difference, I think, in the sort of Montana vibe now that my son is growing up in this environment. And I think that that's really good. I think that balance is good because otherwise, you know, do you look at every you know, at every like stack of lumber and think that that's a moral tragedy? Or do you think like there are ways to do these things and lumber is a sustainable resource and in many ways it would be better than building something from concrete, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a great point. You can about imagine me working for the Arbor Day Foundation, how many times I have people talking to me about trees and cutting them down. But you're right, like managed forests are sometimes our healthiest forests.
The other thing I'll say about my dad working for the Nature Conservancy is that occasionally I would be dragged out. And at first I found this somewhat laborious, but I eventually came around to it, to see scientists in the field doing work. And to see a scientist doing their work is so, I think, very valuable, because you think that a scientist is like what you see on TV. They've got a bow tie and a lab coat and they might be blowing something up or you know, being ignored by the politician about the disaster that is on the way. But you don't see, like, they're out there counting gopher tortoise holes, you know? That's like a totally, I could totally see myself doing that. And then they put it into a spreadsheet and they do statistics on it. And to actually see the work, the everyday work of science was really valuable for me as a young person.
And now you are a science communicator. You are perhaps, without question, one of the most influential science communicators of our time. And it's impressive, Hank. It really is. And it's been fun for me to watch your videos over the years, especially getting ready for this. Was there a moment where you consciously said, I am going to commit to being online? Or did it just unfold organically?
There was never a moment when I committed to being online. As far as like being an internet person, I have always been very interested in two different things. One is technology and sort of how, you know, just that power. In some ways, you know, I don't know how true this is, but in some ways I can feel like technology is the only real way to change the world sometimes. This is very frustrating. It can feel like things are so stodgy and slow, and there's so much, you know, in terms of politics, it's so hard, it's so messy, and but then like technology will just come in and be like, oh, you wanted there to be fewer coal-fired power plants? Well, we invented ways, so many different ways of making power that now coal is literally just a bad idea, like it's economically no longer viable. And that's the thing that actually did it. Like, we didn't ban coal-fired power plants. We did some things that made them more expensive to make sure that they were more clean. And that was part of it, maybe. But ultimately, like, it's just not a good way of making power, and there's better ways. And so I was always very interested in technology. That drew me to the internet. The other thing that drew me to the internet was culture, weird cultures. I love groups of people creating their own worlds together. And never was there a tool that was as good at that as the internet, especially the early internet, when it was just like a bunch of weirdos who couldn't quite find their place in the real world and so found their place online.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. From the very beginning, I was wondering what motivated you. Was it that sense of community? Was it just a fascination with the new medium? Was it your interest in sharing information, or just something fun to start with John?
I think it's a combination of a lot of those things, but weirdly, the last one is probably the least important. And the one you left out was people would pay attention, like, look at me, they would pay attention. I would get attention. And that felt good. But there also really was an element of community to it, like doing things with other people felt very special and sparkly. And then there was simply the feeling of being a part of something very new. I think a lot of people who were in the YouTube world early on, they were wanting to be in the entertainment industry in one way or another. They would spend a little time on YouTube and then they'd go out for auditions for television commercials. And John and I, we're like, you know, in the, I'm in Montana, he's in Chicago. We're just a couple of guys. Like, he wants to be an author. I don't know what I want to be. I at this point in my life, I was actually a journalist writing about environmental technology. And so I was hoping that my career might head off in that direction. The real thing was it felt to me in a real way, and I don't know that this was true of all of my colleagues in the space at the time, it felt like we were at the beginning of something very important. And we were just right about that. I don't know if we were like I should take credit for that because I've been wrong about so many things since, but we were right that we were at the beginning of a very important new thing. And it was and remains a little bit like being around for like I Love Lucy and being around for like the invention of radio. So we got to be a part of that. And that felt really like I had locked in on something.
You know, the community you were talking about, though, could you ever have imagined the level of visibility you're having today with millions and millions and millions of people tuning in to hear your content?
No, and it's kind of terrifying. Like, there are times when I want to rein it in, honestly. And my wife also has maybe used those exact words. So no, definitely not. Though I did always want to be making for an audience. You know, I a lot of creators, they say like, I'm just making for myself. Like, I want to make the thing that I think is perfect and great. And that's just not how I feel at all. I want to continue to evolve and get feedback on everything, single thing that I make so that the next thing that I make could be even better. And all of the people will say, yes, good job. Cause I'm really, I operate with that feedback in mind, for better and worse.
Hank, I appreciate your humility. I really do, because you can see it in your videos as well. You know, you're not right all the time, and you know, you're just trying to be helpful to an audience. But I'm telling you, when I started to tell folks in our office and just some friends that I was going to have the chance to visit with you, I was fascinated by the number of teachers who were like, I turned to Hank Green a ton, both to prepare for their classrooms and or even in their classrooms. I've got a colleague here at the Arbor Day Foundation who teaches a class at NYU on science writing. And when I told her, she told me that a bunch of her students say that Hank Green is the reason they got interested in science. And so it's really cool. It is really impressive. But it's got to feel like this pressure almost. And I'm not trying to stress you out, but this responsibility, knowing that...
Don't worry, I'm already stressed out.
But you're shaping learning. You're shaping learning in so many ways. And you're not worried about checking boxes of curriculum and that sort of thing. And
sometimes I am, but yeah.
Okay. So like, what's your reaction? What is this responsibility you must feel in that space now that you have the audience?
I mean, there's like kind of two main things. Like, one is a tremendous fear that I will ruin myself for people somehow. I'll just get like one thing too wrong, or, you know, a lot of things is more opinion stuff that I am probably not cautious enough about. It's hard for me to pull in my opinions when it comes to politics. The other thing is I have a limited number of hours, and I have to figure out the right things to do with the hours that I have. And I often feel like I am misapplying that resource. And it's true. I think that I could do it worse. I think I've seen people misapply their few resources in worse ways. A lot of people in my business, it really seems like the thing that they want is simply, if they're getting views, they want to use those views to get more views. And then if they get yet more views, they can use those to get more views. Then it's really in the same way that a lot of people I know in the world of making money, they've made money and they're going to use the money they have to make more money until, I guess, finally the hole inside them fills up. But I also have that. I just more have it for, I don't know, certain kinds of approval from certain kinds of people. People like you saying nice things to me. It's going in the hole. It's making it a little bit fuller. It's going to eventually wash out. But for now, it feels good. But I do, like, I really, when I think about what I should be spending my time on, I often think it really, at the base of it, I should be just doing education. That is just having a much more important impact than like all of these like silly videos I make or political videos I make. If I just could focus, but I simply cannot.
Well, I'll tell you what you are incredibly gifted at is breaking down really complex information into information that is engaging and entertaining, but still rigorous. And I'm curious to hear your take on how you process that.
Well, it's something that I've worked a long time on and that I think is really important that I do. I pride myself on that. And when I am when I find a topic that I'm having a hard time communicating, it feels to me like a puzzle that has to have a solution. And solving that puzzle is really rewarding. And I don't always do it. You know, sometimes I never feel jealous of people who I think are doing good work. It's just like not a gene I have. I get jealous of people who I think are doing bad work. I'm like, I cannot believe that you getting so much attention on this dumb idea. And so I will sometimes come across somebody who's taken on a topic that I have tried to communicate, and I think I've done a pretty good job and they've done it better than me. And the only thing I ever feel about that is I wanna talk to you. I wanna put attention on you. I wanna be your friend. It's really about that for me. But it would feel silly to me if I were like a professional guitar player to watch someone do a better job of playing a piece of music than me and be like mad about it. Like, no, I want to know how you did that. I want to know how you thought through that. I want to know how you made the decisions you made. Part of it is really watching other people do it, remembering the times it has been done to me. Also figuring out how, because I'm like kind of dumb sometimes. And like, I think this is important for a science communicator. There's a lot of the process that is really largely about trying to figure out how I get it. Like how do I go from like, you know, having heard of this, but then to actually understand it, have it be part of my system for understanding the world, really incorporating it. And if I can remember that, if I can be sort of analytical about how my brain did it, it's really a lot of steps toward the process of communicating it to someone else.
You're helping to put those puzzle pieces together for a lot of people. And as I've heard just anecdotally, it makes a big difference on folks. And I know you've been doing it for a while and thinking about it for a while. You did a master's thesis on the role of technology in the environmental movement. And no offense, I did not read the entire thing, Hank. Okay?
Not only is that no offense, it's a huge relief.
Okay, good. But there is a line I'm going to read, okay? This is from your thesis. Hopefully you remember it. The people who aren't very interested are the most important part of the environmental movement. And when the movement brings these ideas to them and allows them to realize that they are affected, that's when the movement has the most strength. And there are a lot of people online waiting to be a part of that power. That's from your thesis. And I'm just curious, 20 years later, the internet has changed a great deal. Social media has emerged as an amazing tool. Do you still think that that's relevant? Do we still find people waiting to get engaged? Or what's your reaction as you're reflecting on that now?
I think you picked the best line in the thesis. That's totally yes, correct. I think that is right. I also like it outlines a little bit of naivety about how the internet would go, but I was right to spend all of that time trying to get people engaged through that medium, and people who are doing it now are also right. And the real truth is that the power is in the people who are paying a little bit of attention, you know, because the people who are paying a lot of attention, one, are all the way converted. And two, there's just not as many of them. I don't know. Like it can seem like there's lots of them in my life because, you know, I went through an environmental studies master's program, so a lot of my friends are from that world. But when I get my hair cut and my, barber is telling me about his lifted truck, you know, like that guy doesn't think about global warming ever. It's important not to alienate them. It's also important to create in ways that are open, which I don't always have the easiest time of because the internet really does push us into silos.
On that point, is there anything that has surprised you about how people respond to science content over time? You've been doing this for 20 years now. Is there anything that surprised you about how people are responding to science content?
I think that it has not been so much surprising because, of course, I also respond to science content. And so, but it is, there has been a real education in why people respond to it. And there's like a bunch of fine reasons. But there's only like one really good reason, which is just curiosity. Like the real reason is just wanting to know stuff, like just being a human and being amazed by the world that we are inside of and wanting to know true things about our world just feels really good. But a lot of people sort of start out, I think especially young men can start out wanting to be better than other people. Like that's where it comes from. It's like, if I know enough of facts, then I will be a better person than the people who are dummies and don't know things. And I'm like, anything I could do to lead you from there, which is where some, you know, especially young people often are, to just like, but what's actually feel like to get a new idea? What does it feel like to learn something truly amazing about our universe. And isn't that kind of more gratifying ultimately than whatever thing you thought you were going for here?
So let's move on to the Good Store. I'm a huge fan of the Good Store. I just bought some tea from the Good Store a couple weeks ago. And it is this awesome example of how people can make a difference every single day through their own choices and their own actions. And at the Arbor Day Foundation, we know and we hear from people who feel like they're frustrated in this moment of time around sustainability, around climate. They're not sure they can make a difference in what they do. And the Good Store is an example of where you can make a difference through your individual choices. Do you mind telling our listeners a little bit more about the Good Store and what inspired you to start the Good Store?
Sure. It's at good.store. It is a place on the internet where you can buy a number of products, a whole variety, eco-friendly cleaning supplies all the way to coffee, to soap, to socks, and underwear. We recently launched underwear. And the idea is basically Newman's Own. You know, it's like Newman's Own, but e-commerce. So why is there a way that you can make a store where the profit doesn't go to the owners of the company, but goes to the make the world a better place in a variety of ways? My brother and I developed this relationship with Partners in Health, which is an amazing, very efficient organization that helps build healthcare systems in places that don't have good healthcare systems. And places where maternal mortality rates are very high or where a lot of people are dying of completely curable diseases. And we somewhat foolishly agreed that we would raise $25 million over 5 years. That's a lot of money. That's more money than we had. And we figured that we would do it one way or another. We had kind of a budget of how we would do it. It involved a lot of asking rich people for money, but it also involved a lot of ideas for, you know, ways we could do it. And a bunch of the ideas did not work, honestly, but Good Store was among the ideas, or sort of products within Good Store, things that became Good Store were among the ideas, and they really did work. And so one of the things I've learned in my career is just push on a lot of doors and go through the ones that open and ignore the ones that don't. And so that door opened, and man, we were falling down a hill there for a while. People were like really, and remain really enthusiastic about the idea, where it's like, okay, you're going to buy this stuff anyway. Why buy it in such a way where the profit goes to some billionaire somewhere? Instead, you could buy it in a way that, you know, we share profit with employees, and then everything that's left after that, that goes out to make the world a better place.
It's been over $11 million already. I think maybe even more than that, but over $11 million already going to amazing causes, all of the profits. It's really impressive. And again, it gives people a chance to know, this is just one example of how your individual decisions can make a difference. And is there a particular product that you are most proud of not because of how well it sells, but because of the difference it's making?
The Awesome Socks Club is how it started. So this is a charity sock subscription. You get a pair of socks delivered to you every month. They are designed by a different independent artist every time. It's basically like your feet become a canvas for artists, but you don't pick the artist. So you don't actually know what the socks are going to look like. So it's kind of a surprise that you get in the mail every month. And that product, people have just gone bonkers for. So many people like buy it for their friends, or they get the socks. And if there's like a pair that, you know, they don't want, they gift those. That it's just like such a good vibe.
Are you a big sustainability guy? I know you are. I know you're into nature and all that kind of stuff. Is there a small sustainability habit that you have, a personal sustainability habit that you are just unreasonably proud of?
Oh, for sure.
give us one of them. Give us one of them.
Yeah.
That people are like, I know, we get it, Hank. We know you do that.
When it comes to the depth of the impact on the climate specifically, food is very important. Like, agriculture is much more important than we think it is. It's not all equal. It is an industry. It is industrial. There's efficiencies, and there's efficient ways and inefficient ways. And beef is just very inefficient. And so my brother and I have what are called beef days. And these are the 4 days a year when we can have beef, and they are days to celebrate. And I like this for like two different reasons. One, you know, it doesn't say, you know, beef is evil and we should never have it. It says that there is a scale, and on that scale, you know, 4 days a year is a lot is like almost 100% of the way to zero from, you know, 100 or like 200 days a year of beef. And so that's one thing that I like about it, is like it sort of says, hey, this doesn't have to be all or nothing. And two, I think that any time we get to a chance to like ritualize our lives a little bit and like create moments to celebrate are good. And so a beef day can be like you could decide like, oh, we're going on vacation, we're going to have a beef day, and that's going to be like a thing where I'm going to have a hamburger. Or it could be like a celebration of, you know, something that you want to celebrate in the world. So just like it's a little bit of extra ritual to toss in. I like beef days a lot.
But they're not four set days. You get to pick them.
Yeah, you can.
Okay, got it. Yeah, interesting. And do you text each other, say, I got a beef day coming up. This is going to be awesome.
Sometimes I do hear about John's beef days. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's awesome. Well, thanks for sharing that. You've done some really cool stuff. You're going to be doing a lot of cool stuff. I'm just curious, as you think about your life's work already, what is something you're most proud of in the so far?
Oh, I mean, Crash Course is the thing that I'm most proud of. Really did not. It was John's idea. But I did.
Tell our listeners more about it. Yeah.
Crash Course is a YouTube channel that is focused on making content that is to be used in educational systems. So instead of like, you know, I might make a video that's like, hey, frogs are weird. And that's going to be an education. You're going to learn something from the weird frogs video. But this is like, you know, we'll do biology and there will be 50 episodes that will basically be doing a sort of intro level biology course. And then those videos are, you know, sometimes people watch them all the way through. Sometimes classes use all of them, but usually they're sort of picked one to the other by people who are, you know, studying for exams or by teachers who are, you know, assigning them to students. And it's just been just ridiculously impactful. Like I get stopped like everywhere I go by people who are like, oh, thank you so much. I'm a nurse now, or I'm a paramedic now, or I'm a doctor now. For your anatomy and physiology course. Like that one, I get like, it seems to be very useful for people who are actually on career paths particularly, but sometimes people thank me for a philosophy course that helped them, you know, deepen their understanding of the world, or if they, you know, were doing a degree and they like used the psychology course. Those are some of the ones I hosted. I also hosted chemistry and biology, which are very used courses. We have a lot, but we have many hosts now. We've tackled so many different topics, and it's just out there in the world doing good, and it's free. Educational media is such, here's one of the reasons why I'm so proud of it. That world is so messy and bureaucratic, you know, trying to sell educational media into a school system. Just saying that sentence makes me want to run out into the glacier and die. I would never. But the way that we got around that, the way that we competed with all of these very high margin, very big businesses, is we said, what if the product was really good and free? That's the only way to do it. That was the only way to compete with these big, giant megacorps that are selling into school districts that, you know, you take school board members out to dinner and do your sales pitch. And we're just like, what if we never did a sales pitch? And we let the students tell the teachers and the teachers tell the administrators rather than the other way around, where the administrators tell the teachers and the teachers tell the students. I just love that. I feel so good about it. I never would have imagined that it would work, but it has worked so well.
There's two things you said. It has to be free, but it also has to be good. And both of those things, and it's impressive. I'm telling you, at the Arbery Foundation, we're always looking at how to do more youth engagement. And sometimes that means working with schools. Sometimes it just means with parents. It is so hard to penetrate that education community. And the fact that you've been able to do it in a positive way and in a really engaging way is awesome. So congratulations. And so let me ask you this. This podcast is called Unearthing Optimism. There's a lot of challenges we're facing today. It can be a little dire out there sometimes in the news. Sometimes listening to your videos can get a little heavy at times, especially around climate and stuff like that. But I will tell you, at the Arbery Foundation, we see a lot of momentum and a lot of optimism through our work with communities and planting trees, the disaster recovery work, the hope and the belief that people can come back from these disasters and trees can be a part of it. What for you, right now, as you're looking at the climate, as you're looking at the planet, where are you finding hope? Where are you seeing optimism?
So, I mean, the big thing is that, like, we know that it's possible. So there was a long time when, like, there was no way to, when we'd never seen economies grow without environmental harm growing. But now we have seen that that is doable. It's a thing that can happen. And almost, in some ways, this is definitely true, as like economies grow, they actually start to have less impact on the environment, which seems very counterintuitive. Because so it's very important to me that, like, the lifestyle that I have is not something that is should only be locked away for me. And, like, I like having a refrigerator. I like having hot running water. I like being able to go visit my parents in Indianapolis. And so to say that, like, well, we can't have these environmental harms, we must rein that in. It is true that as, you know, as people get access to more opportunities and you know, economies grow, they do, for a long time, consume more. But then you do seem to reach a peak and they start to consume less. In particular, they start to do less environmental damage because things get much more efficient. So they use less land to make the same amount of food. They aren't burning wood. They aren't burning coal in their homes. More development does not automatically mean more extraction and more pollution. When we look across all of this stuff, across countries, like, as people's basic needs get met, as child mortality falls, as, like, women have more access to education, as energy becomes, like, reliable, as government becomes more stable, environmental impacts actually start to fall, particularly deforestation, which I think is probably pretty important to you, starts to fall. And in America, like, we are reforesting. Now, of course, we lost a lot of forest already, so there's a lot to get back. But we've started moving in the other direction because we care about that stuff and because people's needs are met. Now, we have to be careful that we just don't continue to expand our what we consider to be our needs forever and ever and just consume. But we do see this path, and it's, like, it's very helpful for me because, like, I care a lot about people not living in poverty. I care a lot about them being able to thrive in their world. And it would seem to me that actually those two things are, like, it's one or the other. Either you got to have, like, less environmental impact or you got to have more people suffering. But actually, when you look at it, it can happen at the same time. And they actually tend to kind of be the same thing, because as people's basic needs get met, they want to protect their environment. Nobody wants to destroy. They want these things to thrive, and they want their empathy to be able to be beyond just them. And that inevitably happens when you have those needs met. And so like the thing that you do and the thing that Good Store does, like, in helping with global health, like, those are, in many ways, like, they are serving the same goal together.
We think so as well. And that's all I'm going to bring us to an end here. Of course, we're the Arbor Day Foundation. We're planting millions and millions of trees every single year all around the world in communities and front yards, backyards, and some of those forest lands you talked about. And we started the conversation talking about some of your early memories in nature. But I'm curious, do you have a favorite tree story, or maybe a story of planting the trees or a forest walk or just whatever it might be?
It is so hard to pick a tree story. There's so many good tree, like, so like favorite species of tree. I don't know. That's tricky. Ponderosa pine. Maybe they smell so good. Get up in a ponderosa pine and sniff, but in the crack there, it's okay. Like the best caramel vanilla.
It's a great
smell.
Tree.
If they made that into candy, I'd eat it. It's like a Coca-Cola mixed with a coffee mixed with, like, butterscotch. Ugh. Actually, that sounds great. Somebody put that in a bottle.
It does sound good. Let's go. Let's get that in the Good Store.
Yeah, exactly. As far as, like, a specific tree that I love the most, I have this cherry tree that I take very good care of, and I love the cherries. I use them in a lot of different things. But as far as a tree story, like, the first thing I think of are the big, like, when you plant an oak tree out in the middle of nowhere and it can just do whatever, it doesn't have to compete for a canopy space. The thing they do where they just, like, go down and then come back up and they turn into this giant sprawling oak tree complex. I remember going to trees like this growing up and just them being covered in kids, because you could just, like, they're so easy to climb. And because kids climbed them all the time, the bark was really smooth. That's my favorite, like, tree feeling.
That's great, Hank. That's great. Hey, Hank, thanks for what you do. Clearly you feel the pressure and the responsibility, but the humility the integrity you bring to your work and the impact you make through helping to inspire people to pay attention to science, pay attention to nature, and pay attention how they can be a part of the solutions out there. It's a big deal. So thank you for doing that work, and thanks for being a part of Unearthing Optimism today.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for the work that you do as well.
That's all for this episode. Hank's perspective reminds us that real change begins with everyday choices, with choosing optimism, even when it feels difficult, and with believing that collective action is built one person at a time. To our audience, thank you for tuning in to Unearthing Optimism. And if today's episode moved you or inspired you, we hope you'll subscribe, leave a review, and share the show with a friend. Until next time, keep planting those seeds of hope.